Give me fuel, give me fire, give me that which I desire.
Hey everybody, welcome to Metallicast, the Metallica podcast. I'm your host and fellow Metallica fan. My name is Brandon. This is part 7 of Metallicast Black Summer, my 10-week chronological track-by-track breakdown of the Black Album. Last week was a 2-for-1. I looked at Don't Tread on Me and Through the Never. And I believe that is going to be my last solo show for the Black Summer series, as I have guests lined up for the remaining episodes, including my guest today. He is a returning guest, not only to Metallicast, but the one and only returning guest I have for Black Summer. He is a music journalist. You know him better as Mr. St. Anger. I'm talking, of course, about Mr. Richard S.E. Richard, welcome back yet again.
Thank you for having me. I just could not resist. Like, I was not going to just show up and talk about Holier Than Thou, so...
If you are behind for some reason on Metallicast, which you should not be, because you should be listening the first day it comes out. More than listening, you should be downloading, you should be subscribing. But if you are behind, Richard was here for part 3 of Black Summer. We looked at Holier Than Thou, one of the thrasher tunes on the record. And now we are looking at a song that is far from thrash. Nothing Else Matters.
Indeed. And what a song that is.
A lot to say about this song. Before we jump in, I've been trying my best to keep track of the current Billboard 200 position of the Black Album. Some weeks I have forgotten. Thankfully, the local newsman has my back. I never knew that the local news was so involved in podcasts, never mind Metallica podcasts, but once in a while he keeps interrupting me for these breaking news updates. But I'm pretty sure I'm not going to have a need for him this week, because I'm going to start with it. Guess what, Richard?
What?
Are you ready to hear about the power of Metallicast? Are you ready to hear about the power of the Metallicast Militia?
I'm hardwired for it.
Well, that is very good, because the Black Album is still not in the Billboard 200. But Hardwired to Self-Destruct is back there at number 176.
Yay.
So I've not completely killed the selling, the sellability. Is that a word, sellability?
Marketability? No, that's a different thing.
Come on, music journalist. Come on. You're the one with the words.
The chart presence.
Let's go with the chart presence of... I've not completely killed the chart presence of Metallica. I have significantly killed the chart presence of their best-selling album. Even though it's still up there. It's still, if you look at the hard rock albums, it's still up there. But apparently there are at least 200 more albums that have sold more since I've started this weekly track by track breakdown.
I do have an interesting statistic for you, right? So, in September last year, the Black Album hit a historic 500th week on the Billboard 200 chart. So, 500 weeks in about, when did it come out? Like 18 years ago?
Sounds right. 1991.
Yeah, which 18 times 52 weeks. 936 weeks since it's come out. And so that means it's been on the Billboard 200 for like over half the time since.
Pretty crazy. So, I mean, it was not in the Billboard 200 consecutively before I started recording. So at least I had that going for me, you know, but still shows the power that this podcast holds over Metallica.
What if we've been sucking listeners away from the Black Album? We've dropped so many podcasts that, like, they don't have time to listen to the Black Album, and plus it's fallen out.
You know what? I like it. Let's go with that. Because
we're competition.
Every week they have a new thing about the Black Album, you know? I have a new thing about the Black Album, and they just do not have the time to go back and buy it again.
They're too busy writing their messages on Flickchat.
Thank you for mentioning FlickChat, a free app that Richard is part of, as well as several others. We have a lot of good Metallica conversation on there. If you're not sure what FlickChat is, you obviously have not been hearing me shilling this product over the last several weeks. I'm not getting paid. It's not an advertisement. It's just a cool app that I stumbled upon, and I think it's great. It's not actually officially launched. I guess it's officially launching in September. So we're getting in on the ground floor. It's the next big thing, or not. But it's basically a forum, but it's set around podcasts. You can download the app for free. You can use the code Metallicast. Join Richard, me, and many others, some of whom you'll be hearing about and from later in this episode, when we hear their thoughts on this classic track. But please join. It's growing. It's growing slowly, but it's growing surely. You know, my Facebook started off slow, and now that page is not doing too bad for itself, so I'm not worried.
Yeah, I feel like we have quite the cast of characters on FlickChat already, so.
Yeah. And the cool part is like, you're going to hear later in this episode, I'm going to read some opinions about Nothing Else Matters from a couple people on Twitter, and I do not want to devalue their thoughts, but you're going to just hear a lot more in-depth responses from the members of the Metallicast Militia that are on FlickChat. One, because I think we got a diehard, hardcore base in that app that love to talk. But also, two, you have no character limit. You're pretty much free to write as much or as little as you want, whereas Twitter obviously limits you, despite their efforts to increase character size over the years.
Before we start, I have to correct my math. Actually, the Black Album has been out for 28 years, which I should know since that's about my age. So it's been on the 200, built the 200 for about a third of its run.
You know, 18 years sounded like too little, but I'm too lazy and dumb to call you out and check. So
the crap rolls out in my mouth again.
And your brain is still gelatin.
Yeah.
But the good thing is, Richard, now that we've gotten that fight out of the way in part three of Black Summer, you know, that was our first fight. We got it out of the way. And now I just have to say, Richard, you know, you are in Australia. It's Tuesday morning. I am in the United States. It is Monday night. And just, I feel so close no matter how far.
Couldn't be much more from the heart.
Forever. Trust in who we are.
And Nothing Else Matters.
And scene. So let's jump into the song. I feel like there is a lot to discuss in this episode. Nothing Else Matters, track 8 off the Black Album, the third single released from the album. Let's start off with the obvious, and I think this is going to be something we keep coming back to when we talk about specifics in the song. So without getting too specific yet in terms of, you know, musicality or performance or lyrics, or without getting too deep into that stuff yet, we will get there. Just generally speaking, though, this song, vastly different than anything ever heard on a Metallica record to date when this album is released.
Indeed. I mean, they had ballads, but never one that sounded quite like this, you know?
This was Fade to Black, Welcome Home Sanitarium, One, even The Unforgiven early in the record can all be correctly categorized as ballads, but especially with the 80s material, it builds into this thrash metal whirlwind. Unforgiven never reaches thrash metal, but it has its heavier parts, has a big soaring guitar solo, very epic in its own way. Nothing Else Matters is the most ballady this band has done to date, and the most stripped down in certain ways, the most stripped down they've been on record so far.
Indeed, yeah, it's more intimate than any of their past ballads, but in its own way, it's also grander, like fewer notes being played, but like it's bigger, like more evocative, a lot of space in it.
Yeah. A lot of space that, and it's weird because it's weird to describe a song as stripped down when it features a full symphony orchestra behind it. You know, it's like a very stripped down song, but with a very lush arrangement. But the way it's presented, it feels a lot more stripped down and a lot more raw and bare than what we've heard from Metallica previously. And I think a lot of that has to do with kind of the subject of the song and sort of the story behind the song. So let's start there. I think this is a fairly well-known story for Metallica diehards. But the story goes, and Richard, feel free to interrupt and jump in at any point during this. James Hetfield, he's in the way I've read it described from interviews and documentaries, and the way I picture it in my head as well, is James Hetfield is sitting on a hotel bed. He has a guitar in hand. He's talking to his girlfriend at the time on the phone, and he plucks the open strings on his guitar in a certain order. Now, for those of you who may not know what I mean when I say an open string, that is when you hit a guitar string without fretting anything on the fretboard. You are literally just playing the string as is without adding anything to it. And he does it in a way where he goes, bum, 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 bum. And it ends. What you know is the intro to Nothing Else Matters. He just sort of is doing, and then it catches his ear. He quickly gets off the phone, and he starts writing what I will call a masterpiece.
And I would agree, yes.
And
just to make that clear.
And the not only is this a song that does not sound like something Metallica would record, the lyrics he adds to it, not something you would expect lyrically from Metallica. And because of all that, James Hetfield never intends this song to be a Metallica song. It's just something he says, this is for me. This is for me. I wrote this. It's too personal, too different, too out there. Not for Metallica. It's for me. And, you know, he records a demo of it, as the story goes. Lars Ulrich stumbles upon it and is like, what the fuck is this? I mean, I cannot... It's ironic because... What did you say it was, 28 years?
Yeah.
I cannot picture 28 years later Metallica having not recorded this song.
I know, right? Because it informs so much of their direction with Load and Reload, and S&M probably wouldn't exist without it.
Yeah. Starters. Yeah. And I want to get into all that. I've already talked about how it's personal. So let's start there. Let's start with the lyrics. Usually I save the lyrics for last, but I feel like there's so much. Let's start with the lyrics. I mean, on paper, kind of a love song, right? He's on the road. He's talking about his girlfriend who lives away from him, who he's not seeing. But I feel like that's just sort of what the lyrics are on paper.
Agreed. I want to make a comparison because it's interesting to think that Wherever I May Roam is a song that's very much about being empowered by being on the road. And mm-hmm. Nothing Else Matters was inspired by the opposite. It was inspired by a moment of loneliness on the road. But it still, I think in the end, ultimately kind of embraces that mentality of being like almost nomadic, like almost just you and one more person in a society that's kind of like moving around you, you know, like nothing right. else matters. You're all I need. But I think you're right. Like you could interpret the song as being about a lover, but also about the band itself.
Yeah. And I remember seeing in a documentary, it might've been Classic Album. Somebody out there can correct me if I'm wrong, but Hetfield basically said that, you know, when I wrote it, it was about this specific person. That specific person is out of my life now. You know, it was a girlfriend he broke up with. But he's like, I still find meaning in it because you can also look at it as a brotherhood, you know, whether it be a brotherhood in the band, a brotherhood with close friends, a brotherhood between the band and the fan base. You know, there's a lot of meaning here. In fact, I found a quote from Hetfield. This was a quote from Mojo magazine in December 2008. And he's talking about Nothing Else Matters. And he says, it's about being on the road, missing someone at home, but it was written in such a way, it connected with so many people, that it wasn't just about two people. It was about a connection with your higher power, lots of different things. Hetfield added, I remember going to the Hell's Angels Clubhouse in New York, and they showed me a film that they put together of one of the Fallen Brothers, and they were playing Nothing Else Matters. Wow, this means a lot more than me missing my chick, right? This is Brotherhood. The Army could use this song. It's pretty powerful. So, I think that's the beauty of lyrics, especially well-done lyrics, where people can interpret it in different ways. But that lyric got me thinking, or that quote got me thinking, and a question I want to pose to you, Richard S. He, to put you on the spot a little bit. Are these the most universal lyrics James Hetfield has written?
I think so. There may be some on Load and Reload that don't come to mind right now. But yeah, certainly. Like, even when you compare it to more so-called personal songs by James, like Mama Said or The God That Failed, like, it's more open-ended, but also it never feels like he wrote those lyrics for mass appeal, you know?
Yeah.
They just happen to be relatable and happen to be voiced in a way that is specific, but also very universal.
Yeah, totally. And like I said, when Brian Silver was on for part four, we talked about The Unforgiven. We went into this unexpectedly deep lyrical analysis of the song. But the point was sort of how, you know, I love lyrics that are kind of open-ended and it's not spelled out for you. And it can be interpreted in different ways depending on the person, depending on your mood, depending on your life experience, whatever. And I just feel these lyrics are, if they're not the most universal lyrics James Hetfield has written, it's definitely, I would say, top three. I mean, I feel like these are so easily identifiable to so many different people from so many different walks of life, because everybody at some point has had some kind of relationship, whether it be with a family member, whether it be with a friend, whether it be with a significant other. Everybody has experienced some level of loneliness at some point. I could care less if you are a hardcore black metal fan who listens to Corpse Paint podcasts all the time, or you are like a 10-year-old emo, ugly girl. They might be one and the same, actually, black metal fans and emo, ugly girls. That's not the best comparison for complete opposites. But you get the general drift. People from all opposite walks of life, I feel like, can find something to relate to in many Metallica lyrics, but especially these.
Yeah. I've been thinking a little bit about Metallica's career from this angle, right? So I feel like on album one, they were the fastest band in the world. Albums 2 to 4, to me, they were like the sharpest, the most precise band in the world. Like, everything they did was so, like, precise and so on point. Like, every note mattered. On album 5, the self-titled, they became, I think, the biggest band in the world. But not in a way that was totally calculated, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, you don't end up with songs like this. And what you were saying about this being their most universal lyric, I think that still rings true because, as I'm sure we'll talk about later, I feel like it's Metallica's most covered song, and especially outside of the genre of metal. That's probably where, like, most of the covers of it have come from, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain songs where you're going to get a lot of covers of. There are going to be other songs where you're like, oh, I have like one or two to choose from. This song has hundreds of cover songs. Even if you just go to YouTube and search in Nothing Else Matters cover, you're going to find everything from like a 10-year-old playing guitar in his bedroom to a classical version to a jazz version to all these like female pop singers doing either very doing arrangements, and all the arrangements too, which is awesome about this song. The arrangements are either very sparse, very bare bones, or very lush, very like lavish, very big, very grand. They really run the gamut, and there's a lot of cool interpretations out there.
Yeah, and funnily enough, for a song that's so covered, on no level is it an easy song to pull off. Like the James guitar arrangement is, you know, at least like an advanced kind of guitar level. It's not, you know, guitar 101. And even vocally, to sell the intimacy that James has, very difficult. Like, it's not a showy song. You really need to inhabit that lyric, I think.
Yeah.
And let it build over the 6 minutes of the song.
Yeah, I feel like this could be a song that somebody can easily oversing.
Agreed, yeah.
And this is sort of a vocal performance where almost less is more.
Yeah. All right, here's an observation. So I feel like I never truly understood the way I thought about heavy metal until I read someone tweet like 5 or 6 years ago. I think they said James Hetfield is the greatest metal singer of all time. And I was like, that's an interesting statement. Like, people don't really say it that often. Like, he doesn't get that much credit just for being a pure singer. But then I went back and thought about it, and I was like, actually, I agree, because powerful voice, but very, very expressive. And because his vocal expression is so tied to his lyrics rather than the idea of just melodies or just like the showiness, I think that gives him, a vulnerability that a lot of metal singers don't have. With Nothing Else Matters, it's a great song, but it's also a great song completely like independent of its relation to Metallica. Like, you don't need to know any other Metallica songs to like this. But at the same time, like, that is why it's such a great song, because Hetfield can sing with that vulnerability, but he also can bring that kind of growl later on when the song really needs it, you know?
Right.
And I often think, we all talk about like lead singer syndrome and singers having big egos and all that kind of thing, right? That's very familiar. To me, Hetfield is the opposite of that, because he never conceived himself as a vocalist. Even up to like Ride the Lightning, he wasn't really set on being the lead vocalist of the band. They wanted to bring in like John Bush, and they had auditioned other singers. It's like a role that he fell into by mistake. And so I really admired that about him, because it's just something that, it's like a talent that you don't know you have, that because you don't put an enormous amount of ego or like even kind of pride into it, you just like learn to inhabit it and become great at it, you know?
Yeah. I think all of that is a lot of really good observations there. And I, my personal opinion was always James Hetfield is one of my favorite vocalists of all time. And I think he is the best heavy metal singer of all time, because if you look at, when you think of great metal singers, people always want to name, Bruce Dickinson, Rob Halford, Dio, and all rightfully so, right? They have these, and compared to James Hetfield, all their voices are technically more proficient. They have more range. They have, an operatic element to it. And I'll say this, you know, somebody like Bruce Dickinson, he sounds just as good, if not better, than he ever has. And he's older than Hetfield, you know, and they, you know, they're singing, he's singing the original key. live, and it's all very impressive. But could you take any of them and have them sing a song like Mama Said, or Nothing Else Matters, or Lil Man's Lyric, or do an acoustic cover of In My Life, or Garbage, or Dire Straits, or any of the more, or do Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, or anything like that with the same authenticity and with the same effectiveness? I do not think so.
I think those guys maybe could do a pretty good job, but it's more like the people who all they know how to do is wail that wouldn't be able to do that, you know?
I think, well, let me clarify. I think they would technically be able to do it, but I do not think it would have the same vulnerability, the same rawness. I feel like it almost would be too clean for a song like this. Like, it would be almost too perfect in some ways.
Because it's like, those guys are also great storytellers. That's why they're great frontmen. But they, to me, they tell stories with their melodies and their vocal range and their inflections. It's kind of like an operatic thing, right? Whereas someone like James, when he's singing in that kind of softer context, it's all about the vocal inflections. Like a country singer, for example.
Yeah.
Same deal.
Yeah, exactly. And I also, too, like, I've always been drawn to vocalists that have a more raw, unpolished voice. Like, a couple of my favorite vocalists are Johnny Cash and Tom Waits, who are very, like, warts and all. And I feel like Hetfield is a very proficient singer these days, but he's also sort of warts and all. Like, there's going to be a crack here or there. There's going to be a note that's too flat here or there. But the emotion is always going to be there, and the authenticity is always going to be there. And I feel like a song like Nothing Else Matters, especially near the end of the song, that vocal performance, it's like almost whispered. You can almost hear, it's as close as the voice comes to breaking without breaking. And I feel like it's definitely not something James Hetfield ever did on record before. And on a certain level, as great as his voice has become, and as many great vocal performances as we've gotten from him, I'm not sure he's captured that rawness and vulnerability in that same way.
Yeah, the recording of Nothing Else Matters is very much a moment in time. Like, even the way they played on S&M a few years later is pretty different, and James's voice has changed and so on. But you can tell that James really put in the work and the effort to get to that point. Like, not just in the 9 or so years prior since Kill 'Em All, but also in the 18 months or so that they spent recording this album.
Yeah.
Because you can actually look up the Nothing Else Matters demo, not the original solo one that we mentioned before, but it's like, I think it's a full band one, or at least a four track, because it's like maybe two guitars, a little bit of bass, and Lars's drumming.
Yeah.
And actually, the entire structure of the song, the 6 minutes, is there, but it's funny to note what's missing, because James hasn't gone all the way with the vocal melodies or his singing. Mm-hmm. It's kind of just like laying down a scratch track. And so that to me shows the value of like a producer like Bob Rock and the process that went through.
Cause exactly.
He kind of put them through hell, but he got a perfect recording.
And I this is something we touched upon a little bit in the Unforgiven episode, but I want to touch upon it again now, because the influence of Bob Rock across this record cannot go unnoticed or unsaid. I mean, for all intents and purposes, he became the fifth member of Metallica during the Black Album. But the vocal performances he got from James Hetfield, I mean, this was, if the, Brian and I were saying in the Unforgiven episode, that was like the first time a lot of people ever heard Metallica, ever heard James truly sing. And this is another example of that, but I'll go a little farther and say, you know, it's not just James singing. It's not just a clean, pretty melody. It's the almost surprising soulfulness, the surprising vulnerability that, you know, the emotion that he is able to get across to the listener just from changing his voice certain ways and singing certain ways is really quite remarkable. And that was a big Bob Rock influence. And I know he opens James up to a lot of different things he had not previously checked out before. And James has openly said one of his biggest vocal influences making this record, particularly for this song, was Chris Isaak, who, you know, is somebody from completely left field of the Metallica world. But if you listen to, you know, his most well-known song is Wicked Games, and just has a very soulful voice with a lot of emotion.
I mean, people do say that all popular music comes from country music in a way. I mean, the blues even before that, but you can see kind of how that early progenitor like comes back around to these artists who seem so different but actually have like quite a lot in common.
Right.
It's like we're all storytellers, you know? And
right.
It's like there are only so many notes and so many ways to tell stories and put together these different configurations of sounds.
And that's why I think you have somebody like a Johnny Cash who crosses over into so many different demographics and fans of various genres of music, and including somebody like James Hetfield. And I feel like that's part of the reason why Metallica has been able to do the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I forgot what I was going to say. I'll pick up that Bob Rock thread. Yeah, the value of Bob Rock as producer, not just in the performances he got, but also in the sound of the record, which I think there's really no other album that sounds like the Black Album, and we've touched on that, but Nothing Else Matters is like such an odd-sounding song in itself. It's like it opens with that classical guitar, very soft. There's no radio edit of the song. So quite often there is a cut down version, but quite often you're playing like a lot of that intro very soft. It kind of forces you to lean in and like really actively listen in order to hear it. And then it's like the drums, and it's almost like the drums are the lead instrument, I would say, apart from the voice, because there's so much of that ambience in the cymbals. You feel like you're in the room with Lars and all that space. And the orchestra is actually like, it's there, but it's not enveloping the song in the way that it does on S&M. It's like actually pushed quite far back in a way that's kind of artificial, actually. Mm-hmm. Because you can't get a string section to play that softly in real life.
Yeah,
that it achieves this sense of distance. And actually, now I remember what I was going to say. so imagine being James Hetfield and delivering a vocal performance, right? And imagine the posture that you have to adopt in order to sing a song like Battery or Master of Puppets while playing the guitar.
Yeah,
you're physically quite tense, right? You're playing these very precise guitar. You're picking really fast, you're fretting, and it takes like a lot of vocal muscle in order to hit those notes live with the kind of grit that he does in the studio.
Yeah.
But then you imagine yourself singing the first verse of Nothing Else Matters. It's like a completely different posture. You have to be so relaxed, so calm, and so at peace with yourself. Like imagine doing it at karaoke. Like you can't go all fucking Whitesnake on it. literally just that physical difference shows how far they'd come, I think, and how much it requires to do a song like this.
Absolutely.
Go all the way.
Absolutely. I think that those are all good points. And to, you know, add on, I've read many times Nothing Else Matters described as a power ballad. And I guess in certain ways, maybe it is. But I feel like it's so much more,
agreed.
You know, it's so much more than that. And when I think of power ballad, I'm thinking, you know, a band like Whitesnake or, you know, a hair metal band with, it's a lot flashier, a lot more over the top, and really builds up to another level that Nothing Else Matters does not quite. Yeah, it has the big guitar solo, but the guitar solo even's not flashy. It's more soulful than anything. And it just, it seems like a lot more, if it's a power ballad, it's a very stripped down power ballad.
Yeah. It's like, with a power ballad, when you're listening to it, there's never any doubt that, like power ballads by definition, like they can't be depressing. They can't be sad. They have to leave you with the impression that, oh, you're going to be strong. You're going to be okay. You're going to sing out and hit the high notes and everything. And Nothing Else Matters, even structurally, doesn't do that because it ends in the same place that it started.
Yeah.
Which is still quite soft and that picking. And there's kind of no... There is catharsis because you get the heavy part, but there's no resolution because the structure of the song is a circle.
Yeah.
It's like it keeps going around and around.
It's something that they would sort of duplicate again on Load with a song like Bleeding Me, where you have like the very stripped down beginning verses, builds into the chorus and the solo, but then at the end goes back to how it began. And it very just stripped down and very soulful and very bare bones in a lot of ways.
And that's not a very like metal song thing, because metal songs are very definitive. Like generally they have quite defined starts and ends, even if they do end with like the starting riff or something like that, in the way that Master of Puppets does. But Metallica have had like fade outs before too, like Orion, and even like fade ins like Damage Inc. So
yeah,
I guess that was another sort that they were already playing with.
Yeah. You mentioned the orchestra arrangement. And this is definitely not something I want to just brush over. I liked how you said it's sort of in the background, sort of makes it feel distant almost. And when I at the beginning when I was saying it's sort of ironic because it's a when you look at all of its parts, it's a very lush, grand arrangement. But the way it's mixed and produced makes it sound very bare. It's almost like, I think of it as almost Injustice for All-ish, where you have like the lack of bass sort of adds to the grimness and the bleakness of that record, in my opinion. And having the orchestra in this track kind of muted a little bit, it never becomes this big overpowering thing, but rather just a slight layer to it. That fills in some of the openness, but not enough to take over the song. And it still sounds quiet and vulnerable and sort of, I keep saying it, but just sort of bare, especially compared to the ballads that came before.
And you always notice when the orchestra is there in the song, but you also always notice when they're not there.
Yes.
Not only in the studio recording, but when you hear them play it live without the orchestra, it is great, but you do get the sense that in some ways it's like not complete, or you kind of yearn for that orchestra to be there. Your mind fills in the blanks. Is what I think what I would compare this to, funnily enough, is like the 1920s and 30s and 40s crooners. Like Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, because what they did, those guys, they, you know, literally crooned. They sang very softly over these kind of big orchestral backings, and that's something that could not exist without the invention of microphones and vinyl and recording technology. Because traditionally in opera, you have to be very loud in order to project over an orchestra, because they didn't have amplification back in the day.
Yeah.
That's how they still do it, I think. But when that generation of like jazz pop crooners arrived, they went for that very like intimate kind of bassy voice approach to singing. And that's what, that reminds me of Nothing Else Matters, because again, it's so dependent on recording technology to create this headspace of James Hetfield,
yeah,
to bring you in close and to like really lean in rather than like overpowering you.
Right. I think that's a very good comparison. Well, you know, have you heard the story of them meeting Michael Kamen for the first time?
I believe I have.
So for those of you who have not heard it, Michael Kamen is, I mean, most of you listening probably know this, but he did the orchestral arrangement for the song. And he was the conductor for the first S&M shows with the San Francisco Symphony. And basically, the story of the meeting was Metallica was playing an award show. I'm not sure which one. It was one of the many they played at during the Black Album era. And Michael came and approached them backstage and was like, "Guys, you sounded awesome. I'm Michael Kamen. I did the orchestral arrangement for Nothing Else Matters." And the band was like, "Oh my God, we loved it." He's like, "Oh, really? Because you could not really hear it on the album." and the band has sort of said, you know, they kind of turned it down the mix because they said they like pussied out to a certain extent but I think it sort of like adds to the song personally, like for all the reasons we mentioned already. But they, you know, they were like, "Well, you know, you should check this out." And they gave them a mix of the song that was guitar, vocal, and orchestra and nothing else, because nothing else matters.
And I believe that mix is on the official single.
Yeah, it's on the B-side of the Sabotru single. And it's been dubbed the elevator mix. So, which I also love because the band is like so tongue in cheek towards themselves, you know. But it is.
I have heard elevator music, and it doesn't sound like Nothing Else Matters.
No, definitely not. But it is a really cool arrangement, and very different from the original because the orchestra is right up front. It's definitely more in line with the S&M live version that they recorded years later.
Never care for what they know. Life is ours, we live it, are we? Hold these words I don't just see.
But it's funny that, you know, I kind of mentioned this before, but the song that was so unlike anything they've ever done is arguably their most recognizable song. Definitely one of them. I would say Enter Sandman and this are pretty much, for those people who have never heard anything else by Metallica, they pretty much know those two songs.
And you very much get the two sides of Metallica with those two songs as well.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, as much as they've been covered, if you cover them wrong, that's also like one way that you can kind of see the essence of Metallica. You know?
Yeah.
Because you can't just take the notes and the chords and expect to have that same presence.
Right. And when you hear a lot of the covers, I'm not going to say all the covers, but when you hear a lot of the covers, I think any Metallica cover of any song, I like the ones that go really outside the box and do different arrangements, because I feel like when you do a straightforward Metallica cover, you immediately recognize what that band is lacking.
Yeah. Or like, there are other good covers, like when older bands do it, like Motorhead, where they bring like a different kind of spirit to it. And
true.
It's the reverse. It's like the influencer covering the influence.
Yeah, that is true. I definitely want to mention we sort of mentioned the guitar solo in passing before, but not a Kirk Hammett solo on this track. Mm. One of the few times that James Hetfield plays lead on the track. And
in fact, one of the few Metallica songs with no Kirk contributions in the studio.
Right. If you watch A Year and a Half in the Life of, I believe it must be in the documentary, Kirk's basically saying, like, we're going to premiere Nothing Else Matters tonight. I have to learn the song.
Yeah. And, yeah, because I think Live It is a Kirk intro, right? He plays the entire intro.
Yeah, typically when they play it live, Kirk plays the solo or plays the intro by himself, and then James comes in, and then the rest of the band usually kicks in after the first verse, and then and usually the whole last verse vocally is left out, because usually James will be leaving to change out guitars or whatever, and Kirk will kind of just
ended on guitar most of the time. So it's a very different arrangement live, especially now. I always loved it when they did it, when James did it on the stool. And then when you got to the, you'd kick the stool out. And it, and it was like such a rock star move, but effective every time.
Like in the second part of a year and a half in the life of, when you get the live footage, and it's like after James has had his like burns injury,
yeah.
Super Tech is playing guitar, and he's just forced to like sing on the stool and like really sell it that way, and like he really pulls it off in a way that I can't imagine him being comfortable doing that like a few years earlier.
Yeah. This is I will find a way to work in Sane Anger because you are on this episode. But one of the things we've talked about with that album is love it or hate it or somewhere in the middle. There's a lot of vulnerability in those songs and in the vocal performances. And you hear those imperfections. When I said before, like, you know, sometimes you're going to hear a flat note or a cracked voice. You can hear it on the Sane Anger album, for better or for worse. But I feel like this was really the first time that vocally, and one of the first times lyrically, that he let his guard down to show this different side. And I'm willing to make an argument that without this song, without Bob Rock pushing this song in a certain direction, without Lars Ulrich saying, let's record this and steering the arrangement in a certain direction, we may not have gotten, you know, and some people will be like, yeah, good, but we may not have gotten, you know, Load, Reload, some of the Garage Inc. covers, the S&M performance probably would not have happened, and I think with the vulnerability that you hear on Sane Anger just would not be the same without him being willing all those years later on this album, and particularly on this song, letting his guard down and showing a different side of himself.
Agreed, and they wouldn't be the biggest band in the world either.
Yeah.
Without it. I think in the long run. But yeah, it is funny you mentioned Sane Anger in that way, because you're right, it is like a... It's not a similar kind of vulnerability. It's a similar kind of... They're exposed, they're like equally exposed emotionally,
yeah.
But it's almost like the opposite sonic palette and opposite approach in so many other ways. But that got me thinking about a song like Dyer's Eve, which, again, very personal, very cathartic, and very full of rage, but in a way that, like, I always thought that Metallica couldn't take that any farther than they did.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I keep talking about how the Black Album is a response to Injustice for All. And it, with each track, you can hear that response, whether it be, listen, we wrote a 9-minute song with about 20 riffs. Let's write a 1-riff song called Enter Sandman. Or whether it be, the last episode, James Hetfield lyrically, Don't Tread on Me was a response to his lyrics in Just for All, where he basically was like, in Just for All showed a dark side of America, but I love this country. I want to show, you know, the other side of America. So even the lyrics in that track was sort of like a balance to what we saw in Justice for All. And I feel like Nothing Else Matters, to use your Dyer's Eve comparison, if you take arguably the two of the most personal songs he's written up to this point, and they cannot be more opposite of each other.
And isn't it funny how on the Black Album itself, you have Through the Never, Nothing Else Matters, and then Of Wolf and Man?
Yeah.
No, surprised it's not next to The Unforgiven, but
yeah,
they got the various sides of Metallica.
Well, I always thought it was funny when I had the cassette of the Black Album, and you know, most albums, the way they're structured, you have the radio hits up front, right? So you have the side A of the Black Album cassette. I remember the first 6 songs. So you had basically 4 huge hits out of those six songs. And then Nothing Else Matters was like the leftover hit on side B. Because it was placed later in the album, which is rare, but it's also rare to have an album with five gigantic songs like that. So this is sort of a rarity in and of itself. But
and also fitting for it to be put there when it's like the biggest slow burner on an album that had like a very immediate impact, but also its influence is still being felt today. It's still being dissected today by certain podcasts. but also that song's still being covered, which I'm sure if you go back to 1991 and read like the reviews at the time, it's like a lot of those critics weren't of that generation, so they might have dismissed it outright. Or like B, you have the ones who are kind of reacting to the album in real time and being like, oh, you know, this is a big sea change. But it's like, who could have predicted what would have followed? Like, even Metallica, I don't think could have. Bob Rock maybe could have. Maybe he saw it.
But, yeah. Hmm. And I mean, it, to kind of build on what you're saying, and this is something that's been mentioned before on this podcast, but you have to remember that James Hetfield in 1991 was not the James Hetfield we know in 2019, where he's a lot more vulnerable, a lot more willing to kind of joke around, and you know, you see him in concert now and it's more like, we love everybody, and you know, insert dad joke, and I'm not knocking it, I love it, but it just shows his progression as a human being as he's gotten older. Whereas 1991, he's still fuck you, fuck this, fuck that. And you read interviews from him, and he's not willing to let anybody in. He's like a fucking wall. So for him, for that person, that James Hetfield, to write a song like this is pretty, pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's the template really for the person he would become. And to me, it shows that Metallica of all bands have always had that depth to them, because those sides of James, those sides of the band sonically, they don't contradict each other. It's all kind of part of the same story. Even if one can be a reaction to the other, even if they might not sit well together on shuffle or whatever, it's still the same band. There's still that anchor of James and Lars at the very least.
Yeah, absolutely. This song, it's, you know, it's one of those five guarantees when you see Metallica live. You know you're going to hear Enter Sandman. You know you're going to hear Master Puppets. You know you're going to hear One. And you know you're going to hear this song, Nothing Else Matters. Do you want... I'm going to let you guess how many times it's been performed live to date. According to Metallica.com. I'm going to set my sources as a podcast professional.
I did not look this up in advance. I'm going to guess 1,100.
You're pretty close. It's been performed live 1,217 times. So you're pretty close. The music video, the track, uses a lot of clips from Year and a Half in the Life of Metallica. I remember watching it as a kid and always finding it funny when MTV had a blur. Like the strippers and the Playboy centerfolds of the music stands. Yeah. Yeah. And of course it features the famous scene, which I've talked about before early on in this podcast with my Winger Sucks episode, about Lars Ulrich throwing the dart at Kip Winger. And while that has its origins in a Year and a Half, I feel like it became famous for the Nothing Else Matters video because a lot more people saw that video on MTV than owned the VHS or anything of the documentary.
That video does have a sense of humor, funnily enough. Yeah. Also, Metallicast throwback, I just want to point out that I think it's your cousin's childhood cover of Talk Dirty to Me by Poison is like the most I've laughed at a podcast possibly ever. That may have been what convinced me to like go on the show.
I'm going to have to let him know that. Just a fun fact, that song, that version of the song that he sings as a child, was played at his wedding. Was played at the wedding reception.
Oh my god.
Oh. And I think unknowingly to him at the time.
Wow. Were you responsible for that?
I was not. I don't like to brag, but I'm a lot younger than he is. So I was not in a position to have that kind of power. But I've not let him forget it. I never let him forget that cover, because it's a pretty miraculous thing. So if you go back, it must be in the Winger Sucks episode too, I think.
I think it is, yeah.
But if you're wondering why Metallicast is an episode called Winger Sucks, go download it and listen to it. But no, Winger wrote a horrific song that basically knocks Metallica because Lars Ulrich threw a dart at him.
But the thing is, I bet Kip Winger loves Nothing Else Matters. I bet he's like super jealous that he didn't write it, you know? In more ways than one. Not just the royalties, but like, come on, here's this band, all these bands in the fucking 80s doing like this soft rock shit, you know? And then Metallica, the heaviest band in the world, comes out and does like a ballad that out soft rocks them all, and still heavier than them at the same time, you know.
What's funny too, not only does it soft rock them, but they still keep you know, their credibility and their longevity does not suffer. Like this, for I know there's trues out there that were like, fuck that band, fuck this song, fuck Bob Rock, fuck this, but it really did not. Yeah, but when you, in retrospect, it's not hurt them at all. Nobody's going to say
anyone who dislikes the song.
Yeah. What's funny is that after all the things Metallica has done that are outside of metal, whether it be this song, whether it be you know, the whole Load Reload era, where Lars Ulrich basically would declare in interviews, "We're not a metal band." After all that, everybody still recognizes Metallica as not only one of the biggest bands in the world, but the absolute biggest metal band of all time.
Yeah.
It's like, no matter how hard they try, they will never be not metal. No amount of Lou Reed records will end their, will, can kill their metal credibility.
Because, you know, the less of a fuck they give, like, the more metal they become, in a sense.
Yeah, well, it's funny, because I remember there's not too many metal bands whose, like, t-shirt you can wear. And I just remember, like, being in college and, like, walking down the street wearing a Kill 'Em All t-shirt. And I have, like, this, like, hardcore punk rock-looking kid, like, walking towards me. You know, I'm talking, like, he has the whole get-up mohawk, everything. And you could tell he was just, like, a true punk rock kid. And I see him, like, staring down my shirt. And I'm, like, to the point where I'm, like, this kid's going to make a comment about my shirt. And it's probably going to be negative, because he's going to be, like, fuck you to any band that's, like, mainstream and has sold albums. He seems like that type of kid. And he just stops me and goes, dude, that fucking rules. It was like one of those ones where I'm like, I'm like, they're like one of those bands that's that, like, at least you might not like everything by them, but they have something for everybody.
Exactly. It's like the best way to avoid criticism of selling out or whatever is like to write insanely good songs.
Yeah.
It kind of makes them criticism proof, in my opinion. I mean, not entirely, but like, at this point, 28 years later, if you're still hand-wringing about, like, oh, did they make the right choice in doing the Black Album? It's like, you know, you can't even imagine the world you would live in without it. So,
right.
To me, there's not even a question.
Yeah. Absolutely. Is there anything else we should talk about with this song, Richard, that we glossed over or forgot about before we get into some quotes here that I have lined up by both the band and members of the Metallicast Militia?
All right, I will bring up one thing relating to a version of the song. So there was this trend a couple years ago of like tuning songs into different keys. And one of the most well-known is Nothing Else Matters tuned into a major key. So it goes from E minor to E major.
Mm-hmm.
That version haunts me. It's like very disturbing because it's just so like artificially happy. Like, I don't even change that many of the notes, but oh boy. And speaking of soft rock, like I went back and listened to that just to put myself through the ringer again.
Yeah.
I was like, this in a major key, it sounds like extremes more than words. It's not that far removed.
I definitely have heard that version, but it's been years. I need to go back after I stop recording and check it out again. And that's funny because it's literally the power of music is to make it E minor to E major, you're literally changing one note a half step. It's such a drastically different sound between major and minor, especially for a song like this.
So please don't play that version at the end of the podcast. Oh, boy.
So I've referenced this book a bunch of times. Metallica in Their Own Words by Mark Butterford. Pretty sure there's various editions out there. It's literally nothing to the book except quotes. But there's a number, there's a few that I want to share about the Black Album in general and about Nothing Else Matters, because I feel like it sort of sums up some of what we've talked about today. So this is a lengthy quote from none other than Lars Ulrich. Who knew that Lars Ulrich likes to talk? This is from October 1990, and he's talking about the Black Album, and he says this: "I've heard Bon Jovi this, Bon Jovi that, but the fact of the matter is, Bob Rock's got an incredible ear for attitude and feeling. Now that we've worked with him on pre-production, he's got us kicking ourselves for not doing certain things sooner. Bob's convinced that the four of us playing together has a certain magic or vibe that never happens with me doing drums or click track and James coming in and overdubbing rhythm guitars, blah, blah, blah. We've been very proud of how musically accurate our records have been in the past and how in tune everything's been, but it's gotten so clean and antiseptic that you've got to wear gloves to put the damn thing in the CD player. This time around, we'll probably have more of a feel of what we're after when we're playing live, a lot looser, groovier, underplayed, and overplayed when I want it to be. Being incredibly precise and accurate worked for a while. I'd like to try something different for a change. I think one of our major mistakes in the past has been sitting fucking with the stuff, concentrating on too many details, being too particular. This time it's got a generally looser, livelier attitude, which I hope will be a welcome contrast to the last album being so mechanical. All I can say is that we're letting the riffs speak for themselves for a change rather than diluting them with all the progressive nuances of Justice. It sticks to one thing rather than fucking around needlessly." And I love that quote because I feel like it's not only a description of where they were and what this album is, but where they would end up going. I mean, Load and Reload, talk about playing, you know, loose and playing with more groove, and that was like the whole point of those records.
Yeah, agreed. Like, that quote almost describes those albums more than the Black Album in my mind.
Yeah. I mean, you could see it accurately describing the Black Album compared to where they were, but in retrospect, I mean, the Black Album sounds mechanical in a lot of ways compared to Load and Reload.
Yeah, sure.
This is another one from Lars, this one from September 1991. "Many people have asked me, what will your fans think of this record? I think most of our real fans know that we want to play many different styles of music, and that's something that we started doing on the Ride the Lightning album. We just have to keep doing things to make it interesting. I don't want a band like, no, I want to say Judas Priest, but I think the thing with Iron Maiden was a little misunderstood. I'm one of Maiden's biggest fans. I've said good things about Maiden in interviews for the past 8 years. They're one of my favorite bands, but it's more or less the same, and people expect that. That's why a lot of people like Iron Maiden, but I don't want to be in a situation where you have to give people what they expect from you." This one ties in a lot with the vocals, and you'll never guess who this quote is from.
James Hetfield?
Oh, Lars Ulrich.
Ah!
This one.
Mustaine?
Ooh, so close, no matter how far.
I just want to name check the Megadeth song Promises, which I always thought was like him trying to rip off Nothing Else Matters.
Yeah.
But like at the end of one of their worst phases. So.
I'm trying to think of the melody. I remember the line, I will promise you, the very original line of I will promise you, but I forget exactly how the melody goes.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a good thing. So Lars says, what we started doing this time more than ever before is really working a lot more with the vocals. I'm not necessarily talking about lyrics and shit. I'm talking about vocal melodies. The vocal thing in the past always remained a mystery to everyone in the band but James, because he'd write everything 5 minutes before he'd sing it in the studio. We're treating the vocals on this record with the same upfront attention as the guitars, bass, and drums. We've got all these demo tapes lying around with James going, nah, 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 nah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, it does take quite a bit of vulnerability to even be able to take notes on your vocals from other people.
Absolutely. Especially during this era for that band, where they were so protected for every little thing. Control freaks, you know?
Yeah.
This one is from none other than Lars Ulrich. But this is specific to Nothing Else Matters. We're listening to the track Nothing Else Matters in the studio, and Bob Rock suggested we added some strings in there. So he got in touch with Michael Kamen, who used to do all the string arrangements for bands like Pink Floyd back in the 70s, and he does various film scores too. It's funny because when Bob Rock mentioned this guy, Michael Kamen, he never meant jack shit to me, which is funny considering where their relationship would go. Then a couple of days later, I was watching this movie on video, Lethal Weapon, and in the credits, it had all music conducted and arranged by Michael Kamen. All of a sudden, this guy's name kept cropping up everywhere, so we thought, fuck it, let's just go for it. Anyway, we sent him a copy of the song, and it came back about a week later, and we put it on expecting, you know, a couple violin bits here and there, and, well, he recorded a fucking 30-piece symphony orchestra down at Abbey Road Studios in London. There are violins, cellos, violas, double basses, woodwind instruments. 30 fucking guys play Nothing Else Matters. We were fucking floored. Actually, we felt he'd gone a step too far, because we wanted to retain the original vibe of the song, so in the end we found a good balance. And although the orchestra is still in there, it doesn't take over the song. I'm really proud of it. Which ties in with what we were saying, because we are fucking geniuses.
Hey. Yeah, we only predicted a quote that you would go on to read from like 28 years ago.
Right? this is another one from Lars. He talked so fucking much. Bob should be given total credit for making James feel comfortable enough to take that guard down and really sing on the album. We've always thought of ourselves as big bad Metallica, but Bob taught us a new word none of us had ever heard before. Soulful. As for James's image as a singer now, well, Chris Isaak is his new hero. Nothing Else Matters is definitely one of the highlights for me. When the basic idea for Nothing Else Matters came on Hetfield's demo tape, it was the first thing that really knocked me out. I think James has been a little underestimated as a singer. People will always talk about him as a frontman and, you know, fuck, shit, cunt, piss, and all this kind of stuff. But finally, I think he won't be underestimated as a singer anymore. That's from Lars. And the last one I'll share is from Mr. Jason Newsted. Getting a quick word in after all the Lars from February 1992. He says, we took a lot of chances on this record. Like the slower songs where James is singing, it's all pretty guitars and real clear picking and stuff. People weren't expecting that. It's cool because it shows another side to Metallica. I lied. I'm going to share one more just to get a word in from Mr. James Hetfield himself. He says, we wanted a song that wasn't your typical Metallica ballad. Fade to Black, Welcome Home Sanitarium. The all start mellow, then the chorus is big, then the verse is mellow. We wanted to build it a little more vocally, bring in other guitars. I think the string arrangement on it is pretty fucking cool. If we're going to go for this kind of song, we might as well go all the way. That's James talking about this track from September 91. So that's a lot more quotes than I normally would read for an episode, but I thought they tied in well with our conversation today. Some past conversations we've had on Metallica's Black Summer. And it's my podcast, so I'll do whatever the hell I want. If you don't like it, all right, guess what? Go listen to the Metal Up Your Podcast. No, listen to them and listen to me, please. Please, please. I need the numbers. I need my downloads. Richard, it's now time to hear from the Metallicast Militia their thoughts on this Black Album classic from the Twitter machine. We have Mr. Punt Road. I'm pretty sure that's not his real name. At Punt
it's,
underscore
a main road
RD.
Near us in like Melbourne, Australia.
Oh, you know it.
I know the road, yeah.
Okay. Well, there you go. Thank God you're on the show. So he is at punt underscore RD on Twitter. And he says, it contains a truly ripping guitar solo by Hetfield. Joe, at Metal Fan in Black, writes, good song. Thumbs up emoji. It is a good song. Thank you for sharing. All right. Now we got some Flick Chatters. Download the app for free. Use the code Metallicast. Join Metallicast Militia Conversation. Brian, as in Brian Silver from the Unforgiven episode, says, it truly is a classic. The way that Metallica is able to tone down their aggressive playing for the entire song into a great guitar solo is very impressive. Obviously, the lyrics are deep and very well wordsmithed, but musically, this is an amazing piece. Merriam writes on Flick Chat, probably Metallica's most well-known song, loved by almost any demographic imaginable, the Black Album catapulted Metallica in to superstardom and Nothing Else Matters was largely responsible for that. No, this isn't a song that will be forgotten easily. It's one of those songs that still will be played 50 or even 100 years from now. Overall, it's a very beautiful song. And of course, hashtag be like Ralph. Ralph Savetto, with his always eloquent responses. Ralph writes, this was the other extremely shocking track off the Black Album for me, even more so than The Unforgiven, but both in a good way. It's also a song that I distinctly remember listening to for the first time because of its significance. Yes, Metallica had, of course, written ballads before, but this one was quite different. It was a love song apparently written by James Hetfield, the toughest, most metal dude I could think of in 1991, to his then-girlfriend. It took a bit of getting used to, because this wasn't the type of song my band was supposed to play, but I had an open mind to it as I do to most new music I hear from bands that I enjoy. Eventually, the song clicked with me, and I soon grew to love it. I realized what an excellent piece of music it was and how much courage it took for Hetfield and the rest of the band to put this song out to the masses, because I'm sure they knew they would get shit for it. It also made me aware that one could reveal their softer side occasionally. Anyway, the lyrics are really heartfelt, and I love the Hetfield solo. It has so much emotion and soul to it. The song is also important to me because it was the song my wife and I used for our first dance. I was supposed to give the DJ the S&M version, but goofs. It all worked out anyway because we're still married. And now, on the count of three, Richard, let's give Ralph an aww, one. Sorry, let's do it on the count of 666, because metal! 666.
Aww.
So, just showing, I think, though, those not only do they accurately describe the song and its importance, but also, it, you know, touches upon how many different ways this song translates. Just not, I mean, I would have loved that. I would have loved to have every Metallica song ever written at my wedding, but there's only so many you can realistically fit into the mix. But it just shows the universal appeal of a song like Nothing Else Matters. We talked a lot, or we talked briefly before about cover versions. A lot to choose from. I narrowed it down to four. Made a Twitter poll where I let my Twitter followers choose between Shakira, between Postmodern Jukebox, the other two are right there in front of me, and I just closed it because I'm a podcast professional.
I just opened it. So, Lissy, the folk rock version, and Scala and Kalakni. Choral.
Yeah, which was a choral version. I believe that one was used in one of... What was the movie that came out about the hunt for Osama bin Laden? Zero Dark Thirty? I think it was used in the... I think it was used in that film, if I remember correctly. So we had basically a Latin pop version by Shakira, a folk rock version by Lissy, a jazz version by Postmodern Jukebox, and then the choral version we just talked about. It was a close one. It was basically between Shakira and Postmodern Jukebox, but Postmodern Jukebox edged it out at 46% of the votes. There's a lot of covers out there, though. Are there any cool ones that come to your mind that I did not list on this poll? Not to put you on the spot too much.
Like, the Macy Gray one is kind of different. Like, I'm not a huge fan of it. I have not heard the postmodern jukebox version, actually, so I'm excited to hear that. But to me, in my mind, like, there's never really been a definitive cover of this. It's just, like, it's too difficult.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And like I said, a lot of the covers you hear, they're one or two extremes, right? I listened to one. Yeah. It was somebody can say who it was on social media because the name is slipping my mind at the time, at the moment. But female singer sitting down at the piano, huge symphony orchestra behind it. So it's a very like lavish kind of like pop rock version of it. Then you have, you know, versions that are just a guitar and a guy. And then you have, you know, symphonic metal versions of it. And, of course, Apocalyptica and things similar to that with, like, cellos only. And there's a lot of wide variety of covers out there that kind of fit into all different genres. Share your favorite covers of Nothing Else Matters with us all on Flick Chat or on social media. I am at Metallicast Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So please follow me there if you're not already. Richard, where can everybody find you on the social media?
I am at Richaud, RICHAOD, on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, wherever I may roam.
Nicely done. And I plugged the social media, but which you can definitely reach me on. Definitely plugged Flick Chat already, which you can definitely reach me on. I'm trying to think of as many ways as possible that you can reach Metallicast and be a part of Black Summer, sharing your thoughts every week about the latest track. Next week, of course, will be of Wolf and Man. So you can hit me up on social. You can call the Metallicast hotline, 203-548-0609. It is a Google number, so you can call from your computer, you can call from your phone, we'll go straight to voicemail, leave a message, you can email the show, metallicast@fans.experts.com. And of course, again, social media, Flick Chat, social media, Flick Chat, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Flick Chat, Flick Chat, Flick Chat. Did I mention Flick Chat? You should download Flick Chat. It's free. Use the code Metallicast. I've also sent out the link to the group so you can join directly. I think you'll enjoy the conversation there. If you enjoy this podcast, if you enjoy the people I've had on the show, like Richard, then you'll definitely enjoy the conversations on there because they're pretty much all on there. And we want you to join. So here is the cover of Nothing Else Matters Postmodern Jukebox. I almost said Jukebox Postmodern because I am a podcast professional and I will continue to be a podcast professional next week when I air beef with my guest. That's right. If you thought me airing beef with Richard S. He on Holier Than Thou was bad, wait till you hear my first time guest next week of Wolf of Man, because I got a lot of beef with this guy. Till then, ladies and gentlemen, metal up your ass. Yeah!
So close, no matter how far. I never gave much more from the heart. Forever trusting who we are. Nothing else matters. Never opened myself this way. Life is ours and we live it always. All these words I just don't say. Nothing else matters. Trust I seek and I find in you. Every day for us something new. Open mind for a different view. trust in who we are. Oh, and nothing else matters. Trust I seek and I find in you. Every day for us something new. Open mind for a different view.
Not experts.